Pack station number 10657, reel 14.
Major Lewis, reel 14.
Well, it looks to me as though we we actually left the... we started to move towards the escarpment at 9 o'clock, and we were obviously driving all night before we actually reached Fuka. But we didn't go to Fuka because we were told that it was already in German hands, and 50 Div was advised to make for the El Alamein line, some 45 miles to the east, which really shows how close the Germans were and still doing pretty well, you know, at that time. One or two columns not being warned made for Fuka, where they were trapped by the Germans. This was where Major Cell of D Company was taken prisoner. As the battalion groups pushed on towards Alamein, two or three of them would join forces to form a larger group, and stragglers were also rejoining the columns. Whereas at first it had seemed as though most of the 8th Battalion had been wiped out in the breakout from Matru, things were by this time beginning to look much brighter. During June 29th, the various groups of 50 Div travelled fast all day, and air observers saw an amazing sight as the columns moved towards the safety of the Alamein line, each one throwing up its own telltale cloud of dust. It looked like a sea of moving vehicles. At that particular time, there was a single tripwire which marked the forward limits of the Alamein line, where we arrived late that evening. There was an Indian division was in the area, and the battalion spent the night outside the minefield, not far from the Indian lagers, and the Indians were laying mines too.
So you were really in front of the front edge of the Alamein line then?
Yes, yes, that's right.
It must have been rather exposed.
Well, it didn't matter because the Germans weren't anywhere near, you know. And they, but no, it was very, very open. I mean, the bits where they were having the mines laid was as open as Gazala was, you know. And we were jolly pleased to see somebody actually laying mines, because we hadn't seen any mines being laid for quite a time. So it gave you a little bit of confidence. But I mean, so far as our blokes were concerned, they were so completely flaked out that they just pulled in behind the Italian lagers and flopped out of the lorries and just went to sleep on the ground and passed out, you know.
What did you do then when you arrived at this RV?
Well, what I did was to I didn't go to sleep straight away. I wandered round trying to find out any of my blokes and get them together, which is what most officers were trying to do, was to try and find their platoons and sections and that, and gather them together. And we succeeded in doing that pretty well, so that, I mean, once a bloke had gone down to sleep, you had to leave him there, but we began to get a good idea of how many had got through, you know.
What proportion of your platoon had got through?
I don't think we had a... I don't think we did too badly, actually, as a platoon. I can't recollect. We certainly didn't have heavy casualties in the platoon or anything like that. So I don't think that they were caught in the bottom of the wadi. I think they were able to get out, more or less get towards the exit when I did, because we would have all been pretty close together, you know.
Apart from being tired, which you've described, you know, what sort of state were they in?
Well, jolly pleased that they were still alive, really. You know, a sense of sort of relief that that particular thing was in the past, as it were, because it was a pretty frightening business. It's always frightening when you don't know what's happening. It's not frightening when you know what's happening. If somebody's firing at you, they're firing at you. You can go along with that. But when you don't know where it's coming from or how many of them there are, it is very, very difficult to sort of shape up to it. And that's where good training comes in. You know, that's where Jennings and Fearon, with the stand they put up from the Wadi, were showing the damn good examples of how you've got to be able to react quickly to a situation like that.
Did they both get out of the Wadi?
Yes, RSM Jennings and Private Fearon, yes, they both got out, which was pretty good, actually. Yes, old Spike Jennings went on to be commissioned, actually, later in the war.
How did you get hold of water and food then when you arrived at the Alamein?
Oh, that would have been laid on, because the I must say the sort of B echelon stuff was good. They would have known before we arrived that 50 Div was making for Alamein. As soon as they couldn't make for a Chroma, as soon as they couldn't make for Fuka, then the RASC lorries and convoys and that with food and drink would have been redirectioned towards the actual Alamein line bit. So, you know, that was pretty good. I mean, you didn't have to wait long before there was... I mean, that was one of the most important things in a battalion, that they got something to drink and hot food as quickly as possible and as regularly as possible. They appreciated that more than anything. And if you've got good quartermasters, which we got a damn good battalion quartermaster, he would have been worried all the time as to where we were going to end up, and you know, getting in touch with the brigade and saying, right, and this is where the 8th battalion is coming out, what are you going to do about getting some stuff over there for them?
So was this RV then predetermined? Had it been...
It was predetermined to the extent that I mean, they had to do a quick change of direction, because the Fuka was held by the Germans, and we'd been told to make for Fuka. Because it was held by the Germans, so somebody had to act quickly and know where we were going to end up.
Do you remember how you got the word of where to go?
No. Oh, well, that would have come down from the CO. I mean, the CO would probably have been told by a brigade.
But by what means? Because the last I understood, you were in a 1500 weight that you'd got into virtually at random, going across the desert. How did it reach you? Was it passed by radio or by traffic controllers standing on the ground?
No, nothing like that. I would have thought that probably what would have happened was that when they had, you know, when I think the following...
Because D Company didn't get the word, did they?
No.
They went on into Fuka.
They went on into Fuka, so they weren't stopped. I mean, they may well have been ahead of us, maybe by an hour, or not, couldn't be more than an hour, but they may have been just far enough ahead to have not known that Fuka was occupied, and so they just went straight into it. But you see, we spent the night outside the minefield, not far from the Indian lagers. Now, what would have happened the following morning, with people like Jennings and that around the place, they would have gathered the battalion together. Now, whilst the battalion was being gathered together, platoons and companies and everything, then the CO would have been contacting brigade headquarters to find out where he got to, what he got to do next.
But I don't understand how they managed to get all together in the same sort of area.
What, to Alamein, you mean?
Where they could be collected up, yes. How did the information get to them as they were careering across the desert?
A good question.
That was the place to make for.
One or two columns not being warned made for Fuka, where they were trapped by the Germans. Well,
I would have expected after the scattering they'd have been spread all the way along the Alamein line from virtually from one end to the other, rather than appearing opposite the Indian line.
Well, if you were on, let's assume you're on a compass bearing, you've got to take a compass bearing. We were given compass bearings before we left Merzimetru, that having broken through, gone over the escarpment and broken down, you then turn on a compass bearing of so-and-so, and that will take you to Fuka. We had to be given something like that, otherwise we wouldn't have had anything to guide us. Now, that means that most of the columns that got out of the wadi are eventually going to be coming
towards Foucault on that bearing.
route, on that bearing. And I can only think that at some stage or other the columns were intercepted and told, no, not Foucault, Alamein is where you've got to go, and the compass bearing is so-and-so. It would have been something like that. And I think that's quite possible, because, as I say, they would have had to have followed more or less the same route, you know, having gone over the top of the escarpment and then continued and then off towards Fuga. I don't think that would necessarily have come from brigade. It might have been something that the military police were laid on to do. I'm not saying it wouldn't have a bloke necessarily standing there, but you'd have had an area that was pretty well covered by, and after all, the columns could be seen a long way away, with all the sand and dust and everything going up behind them. So I think they would have been redirected at some stage when it was known that Fuca was in German hands. But they either didn't spot the D Company column, or the D Company column arrived too early to be spotted. That could be. But by the time we got to Alamein, then it was quite easy, really, to pull the battalion together again. It says early the following morning, this was June the 30th, the 8th Battalion passed through a minefield gap in the line. There was considerable activity as anti-tank guns were being manoeuvred into position. South African and Indian infantry were digging trenches. Concrete pillboxes were being manned and minefields reinforced. It was most reassuring and reasonable. And that, I think, is a bit of good foresight on somebody's part to have got all that going whilst everything was happening not much more than 24 hours earlier. I must say, it gave us a lot of confidence to see what was going on in the Alamein line.
Sounds as though the Alamein line was a lot more impressive than the Gazala line had been.
Oh, yes. Oh, it was, yes. It definitely was. You'll see later on, if I remember rightly, there were two minefields, a forward one and a rear one. Of course there were at Gazala as well. I don't know whether it was any more impressive. I don't think it was. I mean, you still lived in holes in the ground.
But in terms of defensive strength,
mentioning
things like concrete pillboxes.
Well, I never saw a concrete pillbox anywhere.
Not in the Alamein line?
No. Not certainly where we were, down in the south. And I never saw any when we came up to the north. So this must have been something to do. It couldn't have been anything to do with the Italian frontier, because we were beyond that, weren't we?
Yes, we were behind the Italian frontier. Mm. What about wire? Did they have any wire in the Alamein line or anything of that sort? Did you see, when you passed through it, through these Indians and...
Well... So on? When you pass through it, you would go through a minefield gap, and you would have the wire stanchions and the wire lining the gap from stanchion to stanchion, and then it would disappear over that way, and on the far side of the gap it would disappear over that way, and there were just blokes laying mines. That's all. There was nothing else. It was a piece of... I mean, you wouldn't have known it was... I mean, you knew it was a line because it was the first obstacle, anti-tank obstacle, that we come up against since the Gazala line, in actual fact. So it obviously was the Alamein line, but there was really nothing to tell you that it was. I mean, we knew we were going through it because we knew that that's what we... because we expected to see something like that. But nobody said... Oh, you're in the Alamein line. I don't think anybody told us we'd reached the Alamein line. But there was quite a lot of activity, but it was open desert with a minefield gap and chaps on either side laying mines.
So you went through the Alamein line, and then I think you went on, didn't you, to Mariupolis eventually?
Yes, that was
by
afterwards,
stages.
Actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Concrete pillboxes. Now, I don't know about that because I don't remember any. The battalion transport vehicles were now breaking down in increasing numbers. Some of them looked as though they were returning from a bright outing, with men from trucks which had been abandoned clinging precariously to the sides of those which were still running.
It mentions the mileages, 30,000 to 40,000. Was that a sort of maximum mileage in the desert?
Well, I'd have thought so. I mean, you see, these trucks, I think, we took over from the 4th Indian Division, or the small trucks, the 1,500 weights, and they'd had them in the desert when the Durhams were in Iraq. I mean, 30,000 to 40,000 miles under those sort of conditions was pretty good going, you know. I'd say that I wouldn't have thought you'd get much more out of it. Not in those days. You might today.
What was it in particular about the conditions that wore them out? Was it just the dust getting into the engines?
Oh,
or
the suspension.
The suspension
and the surface of the desert and the sand, the damn sand got into everything. Got into brain guns, it got everywhere, you know. And then when they used to go through this sea of sand, I mean, the whole truck was completely engulfed in it, you know. I mean, they did a marvellous job to keep the things running. And these, if I remember rightly, these were American open trucks.
Chevrolet,
I think, from the 4th Indian Div, which they took over. We got our own 1,500 weights, British ones that had come out, you know, reinforcements and that sort of thing. And we had a rest 2 miles east of the other main line, where the remnants of the battalion reformed to some extent. The 8th Battalion was directed to a divisional rest area at El Haman, 20 miles to the east of the other main line. So by now we're through the other main line and 20 miles nearer Alexandria. The missing Company C rejoined the battalion here. The Matru breakout had been an expensive action. 17 3-ton troop-carrying lorries were lost, many of them in the Wadi. 17, that's a lot. I mean, if you're taking, that's about 3 companies, really. Because, I mean, on that particular operation, the 3-tonners would have been pretty full. It wasn't, you know, you've got to move everything. So they wouldn't have been travelling light. 17. One of the RASC drivers said, "There's never a dull moment when we're carrying the Durhams." They were very good, the RASC. I hand it to them. They were damn good, actually. They always, you could always rely on them. Always. I think that's the 40 miles from Alexandria, the other main line.
So you're really midway between the two.
Just look at, yes. We went July the 3rd, we had arrived in the fly-ridden camp of Mariupolis.
Were you aware of the general situation when you got to Mariupolis?
Yes, in fact, what had happened was that Rommel had followed pretty close on the heels of the 8th Army, and had arrived in the vicinity of the Alamein line by June the 30th. Now, the line itself was about 40 miles from Alexandria. I don't think people realise the tremendous amount of work that General Auchinleck put in preparing the defences before the various units started arriving back there. Quite a lot was done, and I think had it not been done, we might have been in a very much worse situation. So far as the line was concerned, the Mediterranean was on the northern flank, and the Qatara Depression, some 40 miles to the south, was the southern flank. And there was no way of getting round the southern flank because of the nature of the terrain and the desert. There was fierce fighting more or less when Rommel arrived, but 50 Div wasn't involved in this, and on July the 1st the division left El Haman for Mariupolis Camp Amaria. The camp was 1 hour by truck from Alexandria.
Now, you described the camp earlier on as being fly-blown.
Yes, Mariupolis Camp in fact was worse than Gazala. It was fly-ridden, depressing, dusty and dirty. made up of corrugated cookhouses, washhouses and tents. The Desert Air Force, some of the Desert Air Force landing grounds were close by, and there was more or less a permanent dust storm enveloping the camp. Every time the fighters and medium bombers landed or took off, there was another swirling dust cloud that came over the camp. It was not much favoured by any of the people who spent any time in Mariupolis camp. On the other hand, of course, Alexander wasn't far away, and leave parties used to go in to Alexander in three-ton trucks. They were day trips, most of them, but Alex was a very pleasant place. I always thought more pleasant than Cairo because of the sea breezes. And when the troops went in there, they got baths, they got haircuts, they had their shoes shone, they had a marvellous time, and then came back again to Mariupolis camp.
How big was the camp at Mariupolis?
Sorry?
How big was it?
How
big could it hold?
I don't remember. The desert's such a vast place, really, that you could... that they could probably have expanded it, you know, with a few more tents to hold a lot more if they wanted to. But we had the idea there was to reform the brigade and also to reorganize the remnants of the battalion, and we were reinforced at Mariupolis with 46 other ranks, which really did nothing very much to bring us up to our war office establishment. We were still well below that. But I would have thought that the camp would certainly be large enough to house a brigade.
These 46 men, had they come out from England?
They would have come out from England, yes, at some stage or other, but the trip out used to take about six weeks, something like that. I think it was 6 weeks to Durban, actually. So they'd probably come out May or something, or April or May in 1942.
Do you remember where they'd come from?
No, not this particular draft, I don't, actually. I don't think there's any record of that.
Did you have to absorb any of them into your own platoon?
Well, I wasn't at Mariupolis very long, so I can't remember being involved in training anybody, because from Mariupolis I was whistled off to Sidi Bish as adjutant at the rest camp. So I didn't have a lot to do with Mariupolis. But soon after we got there, the Alamein line was more or less fairly safe. This was about the 3rd of July, with General Auchinleck still in charge. So that after a fairly brief period at Mariupolis, I went into Alexandria to the 50 Div leave camp, which was at Sidi Bish on the outskirts of the city, and a very pleasant place indeed. It was under command of a Captain Harry Idris, I-D-R-I-S, of the Divisional Provo Corps, who had had the unfortunate experience of being shot up by Messerschmitts on one occasion, and had gone to ground in a cactus bush, and his hands were still heavily bandaged from this incident. He was a very, very reasonable chap indeed, and the first thing he told me when I arrived was, if you find any gaps in the perimeter wire, don't worry about them too much, because it's for the chaps who come in late at night, so they don't have any embarrassing situations at the guard tent. The food at the rest camp was absolutely first rate, organised by the 50 Div catering officer. I think as a division, they were always very much aware of the fact that, you know, food was a very important part, a very important thing so far as any unit was concerned. And they always went out of their way. Certainly when they were at Sidi Bish, the food was terrific. When we were in the line, they always used to get hot meals up to us whenever they could. The troops at Sidi Bish used to go out from after breakfast in the morning until late evening. And on one occasion, General Nichols, who commanded the division, visited the camp when he'd been told that a new leave party had arrived. And he found about eight or nine chaps sitting around a table, eating a meal of salad and pressed beef. And he said to them, "Well, this food looks jolly good." And the reply from one of them was, "Well, it should do, sir. We're the cooks." In fact, all that was left in Mariupolis camp was just the cooks.
What sort of numbers could this camp hold?
Sorry, I'm wrong there. When I said Mariupolis camp, I should have said Sidi Bish. I would have thought Sidi Bish was big enough to hold a battalion, you know, quite a lot. It wasn't just a small camp, it was a fairly large one, actually.
What accommodation did they have there?
I don't honestly remember. Most of it, I would have thought, would have been tented, mostly tented. But I can't recollect, actually, whether it was tents or whether it was wooden huts. More likely to be tents, I would say.
How did they get into Alexandria from there?
Well, it was very easy run in. You could, I mean, taxis would take you into Alexandria. I think Harry Idris used to run a truck or trucks in, which used to pick them up and go back again for another load during the early evening.
As adjutant, what did you have to do? What were the sort of duties of the office?
Well, not very much, really. I mean, all I had to do was just to back up Idris, you know, and make sure that the cookhouse was operating properly, that the field cashier came round so that if any of the officers wanted to draw any money, it was available, and troops as well. We had to arrange for them to get their pay. Had to make sure that somebody kept the cookhouse clean and the latrines clean and the ablutions and all that sort of thing. And generally speaking, that when they did go into Alex, they were fairly smartly turned out. It wasn't a very difficult job at all, really. It was quite an easy one.
Did you get any disciplinary problems with?
No. Not that I remember, no. No, I don't think so. I mean, sometimes they used to come back in the early evening, so not a lot of them stayed out all night. They were supposed to be back in the early evening. If they wanted to go out for a couple of days at a time or something like that, they'd have had to have asked for a special pass and have a special reason. But Sidi Bish really was a camp on the outskirts of Alex for people to use and go into the city during the course of the day.
Did you get into Alexandria?
Yes, oh yes, went into Alex just as much, really, as the troops did. I mean, there was no sense, really, in staying in the camp, although it was very comfortable, although the food was good and the living conditions were good. Alex was so close that it was silly not to take advantage of it. We used to spend a lot of our time at the Carlton, actually, I remember, which was on the seafront. And when we first went into the Carlton, there were quite a lot of Axis flags, Nazi flags, hanging out of the windows of one or two of the apartment blocks along the seafront. This was when Rommel had first arrived. But we noticed after about 48 hours, when the position had been stabilised, that the flags had all disappeared.
What was the Carlton? Was it a hotel?
Carlton
or
was a bar and a nightclub, basically, but you could go in there at 5 o'clock if you wanted to. I mean, nobody, like everywhere else, like Cairo, people didn't move around much in the afternoons because it was too hot. If you did anything in the afternoon at all, you'd probably sit in a cinema for a couple of hours, which was about the only cool place to go. But the evening's activities used to start about 5.
Did You mentioned the Axis flags. Were there any parts of the city where the troops weren't supposed to go, which were under a...
No. Because there might have been demonstrations or something?
Because they might have got themselves into trouble
one
way or another.
No, not really. Oh, sorry, this has come off. It's my fault.
You mentioned the flags. Did you see any other manifestations of
no.
pro-Axis
Nothing at all.
Feeling?
No. No, there was nothing at all. It was, there are quite a lot of French people in Alexandria, and I think there was a little bit of anti-British feeling there, although the Oran, I don't think by that time the Oran business had happened, had it? You know, when we had to shell the French fleet. I don't think so. But in fact, I mean, they were really very friendly towards us. I remember once coming back from, well, this was way ahead when we'd come back all the way from Tripoli, actually, and we used to stay at a hotel on the seafront, and we drove the jeep into the hotel down the sort of paved approach road, and on either side the residents were having their afternoon tea, which was a bit shattering to them to see a jeep come in with mortars and Bren guns and bags of grenades and things hanging off of it. But they weren't at all upset by it. In fact, dear old lady came up and she said, when you've had a wash and brush up, she said, do come down and join us for tea. So I don't think there wasn't a lot of anti-feeling against the British in LX, but there were a certain number of people there who didn't show themselves who were pro-German or pro-Italian and would have come to the surface if the Germans had arrived. But all we saw of them was just these few flags that were hung out along the seafront and which subsequently disappeared.
You mentioned that there was the Carlton, which was a club and bar.
Mm.
What sort of places could the soldiers go to?
Well, there was the only... I mean, they used to go down what we used to call... I think we used to call it the Burka.